This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey, this is Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. We are back for another session with Rob Hahn. He is the founder and managing partner of 7DS Associates and has done everything from working in finance, corporate law, technology, product development, media and entertainment, startups, fashion, and even a professional card player. You'll catch him on his blog, Notorious ROB, where he opines on real estate topics, technology, marketing, and strategy. And you'll also find him at industry events like Inman Connect, T3 Summit, as well as local, state, and national association events. Our community tends to be a little behind the eight ball when it comes to technology, as are, especially in this market, at least here in California. You know, we've gone through the cycle of short sales, REOs. Those are a very small portion of what's going on. And a lot of our network is getting leads directly from equity sellers. That can, you know, come from people who are dealing with the death, disease, divorce, a job change. You know, they have to get out quickly for very specific reasons. Or maybe a landlord who's looking to retire and they just don't want to have to deal with, you know, kicking tenants out and all that kind of stuff. So issues, and there's hair on it. It's not like you're just buying an REO that's got free and clear title. It's more complex. So yeah, I mean, you're right. If they were to open this up and somehow pre-qualify the investors, somehow know that they had funding behind them, yeah, this becomes another avenue of leads. Very competitive, however. So, you know, a lot of the mom and pop real estate investors probably aren't going to be able to buy at some of the numbers that these hedge funds are buying. And it is a little disappointing because there is always a sense that some of these hedge funds don't necessarily care anything about the local market. It's all about numbers, where mom and pops, for the most part, are going to be located in the jurisdiction and care, hopefully. Then again, you've got politicians who hate landlords as well. So what are you going to do?
it's a complex web. You know.
It is.
I think the 15 is just because they're running a test in two markets. It's not clear that this will actually become a full-blown product. I suspect that it will because, you know, Inman put up a post like within a day saying that there's, you know, one of the agents that are participating in this got 48 listing leads off of instant offers, right? 48. And when I think about how desperately, you know, the realtor on the ground wants listings, that's sick, right? Especially in this low inventory environment to get 48 listing leads. I mean, if she converts 10%, right, that's four listings. I mean, that's, there'll be a line, you know, there'll be like a cordon of realtors around Zillow's office just like yelling at them saying, take my money. So I suspect this will become a product. But, you know, we'll see what the full product looks like when they come out with it. I suspect it'll be, hey, let's open to all investors as long as you qualify and you can prove that you actually have the money. Do you know what I mean? And you're not a con man or, you know, what have you.
No, exactly. And what markets they decide to choose. So for now, Instant Offers is only in Orlando and Las Vegas, and Open Door, Phoenix, Dallas, Fort Worth, and Las Vegas. And I read that they were hoping to maybe get into Atlanta, Georgia, and Portland, Oregon, but they were hoping to be in 15 markets by this year and 30 markets by next year. So I thought that was just interesting that maybe it hadn't gone as quickly as they had hoped.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think, I don't know. I mean, the way I look at it, they've considered the amount of capital they have behind them and some of the folks that are involved with it, and the amount of capital that Open Door and its people could tap. I'm not actually all that worried about them. Right. I'm interested to see what they do next.
Open Door, I think, has a very interesting inside gateway to probably 1031 exchanges as well. That exchange market could really be facilitated in a lot more thoughtful ways than currently is available. So, yeah, we will. And, you know, as a realtor right now in this market, I think, you know, long gone are the days where access to the MLS really means much of anything. So it was funny last year.
You should probably have a conversation with the folks from, like, say, the Realty Alliance, you know, who make a huge deal about the whole participant versus non-participant distinction and access to the MLS. I mean, it's like they're the holy grail. I don't know what I think about that, actually. You know, it's maybe access to the MLS is not meaningful at the surface level, but maybe it is actually really meaningful if you're in a transaction, you really need to get down to nitty gritty. You
know, I'm not sure. It's a tool, but in and of itself, I just don't think it's the end all be all. And it's very difficult for maybe traditional realtors who have been around a long time where, you know, it was only 15 years ago, we were still doing faxes and transacting a lot in paper. You know, my dad was a flipper at the time, and, you know, in the back of the car was always a Thomas Guide map. I haven't seen a Thomas Guide map in probably 20 years. So it's just really, really changed. And the technology is moving so quickly in so many channels. So I'm sure as you're talking to these Inman events and these different realtor events, is there a real sense of, I don't know, what's the feeling like at these events, at least from the realtor perspective?
I think the feeling is anger motivated by fear. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I wrote about this a few years back, kind of actually even around this whole syndication thing. The issue is if you've been doing things a certain way for 30 years and, you know, the rug gets pulled out from under you, like just when you got used to one thing, the next thing comes along, you know. And I think a lot of them have a difficult time just, you know, adjusting to the pace of change. And in that sense, I don't think they're any different than lawyers. I don't think they're any different from doctors. Do you know what I mean? Like, you think about what things like outsourcing or AI does to the legal industry. You know, somebody who's been a lawyer for 30 years, they're just not going to be able to adjust fast enough. And I think that's driving a lot of this emotion, right? Because that's what it is. It's emotion. And quite frankly, a number of folks are just plain scared. They don't know what to do. They know they can't do it, right? And they don't know what that means for them.
I teach a lot on marketing and technology, specifically in the real estate space. And whenever I speak in front of realtor groups, I always ask them, where are the majority of your leads coming from? And without fail, you've seen all the data. It's relationship driven. And that a huge majority of buyers and sellers use the people that they know within their network or they get a referral from, and they use the same people over again. So, you know, I just always say, you know, just go with what works. Why are you worried so much about being on Snapchat? And, you know, it's noise. So building that relationship is really, really important. And that seems to be getting lost in the fear of the technology.
I think it is. And I don't know who to blame for that, to be honest, right? I don't know if it's, let me put it this way. The thought did occur to me that maybe the problem is the real estate vendor community and the real estate consulting community. Right. And I belong to both of them, I guess. And, you know, like a big sort of sales tactic, you know, in this business is going and scaring the living pants out of a realtor. Right. And let's face it, the average realtor is like 58. Right. Mm-hmm. And saying, hey, you know, the millennials are coming and they're really with it and they're on Snapchat and they're on their mobile phones. And if you're not, then you're screwed and you'll be out of business. I don't know. And we've been doing that for a good 10 years now. So yeah. I don't know if that's part of the blame. You know, where, you know, the way that we want to sell a product or a tool into the industry is to scare people and say, you know, if you don't buy this, then you're out of date and you're irrelevant. I don't know. I think there might be some truth to that because fact of the matter is you're right. Now, you look at all the data, all the numbers, you know, most of the business comes from referrals, yep. Right? Most referrals, all this agitation around online leads. You know, I saw a stat from like last year, Inman did a study. And put up, and it was like 11% of buyer leads come from online. 11%. And I'm going, we're making all this big hoopla over 11%. You know, percentage of seller leads came from online? Less than 1%. So wow. It's like, yeah. So to me, I think the interesting thing is the industry as a whole, you know, the associations, the MLSs, the brokers, you know, they're all kind of absolutely obsessed with Zillow, with online, with apps, with technology, all this stuff. Meanwhile, the agent on the street who's just, you know, doing business, chances are they're probably getting all that from relationship they built over years and years or, you know, people from church or from community organizations or what have you. And like nobody talks about that because it's not sexy, right? Like there's no vendors that make money, you know, say, go to your PTA meeting. Like, you know, no one's going to pay you for that. So maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. And then when I talk about this, I'm like, you know, I transact with people that I know and trust. I'm very involved in a lot of nonprofits locally, and there's specific realtors who own specific areas in my head, whether it's a specific inventory type, whether it be commercial or historic homes, or maybe it's a geographic area even within my city, or maybe special kinds of transactions. There's so much opportunity to make it human where the real fear is in the technology piece. And I'm just like, wow, we just need to get away from that. And I beat them up with a lot of charts showing them, you know, why that is. So, but if you were a realtor right now, what would you be focusing on?
If I were a realtor right now, I'd be focusing on making sure that my sphere, my neighborhood, my farm, right, knows who I am. And two things about that. Number one, I need them to know that I care about them. Okay. Because I wrote this on the post, but, you know, Zillow can out-tech you, but they can't out-human you because they don't have any human beings on the ground. So that's the first thing. Like, and the thing about the human part of the relationship, when we talk all that, ultimately comes down to this person cares about me, right? Now, the person might be paid to care about me. It might be a sales tactic. And yet we know, you know, if I feel like, hey, this realtor or this lawyer or this doctor actually cares about me, I'm happy to send them money. I'm happy to do business with them. So that's the first thing. I think they need to know that you care. And the second thing they need to know is that I'm a local expert. I've done this a bunch, you know, that I'm on top of, you know, local development efforts or changes in zoning law or, you know, whatever. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, it can't be just, I'm really nice and I have a nice smile and I'm friendly at the soccer game. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like that's enough. It needs to be, you know, that this person cares about me. And in this one area of real estate, buying and selling homes, this person knows more than I do. If you do those two things, I don't feel like the rest of this is, you know, it's a threat. I don't think it's a danger. I'm just not worried about it.
I would agree. And same for real estate investors. It's a very relationship driven business. And the last couple of weeks on the radio show, we had Andrea Jennings. She's a local realtor who sort of, you know, does side business, does flips on the side. But her and dad started working together like 20 years ago, and she was the agent representing him. And it was interesting because we were doing a show on first day listing MLS and investors being able to buy the properties, being first to the market. And of course, that's changed because once you get outside of paper, you've got probably thousands of people getting instant updates when something gets listed. And it's so interesting that the relationship piece was so important. So maybe it's almost practically impossible to sometimes get that deal because you're the first to write the offer, but that's not the intent of that transaction and that meeting. It's to build a relationship to get the next one, or the difficult ones that aren't selling, that got hair on it, all that kind of stuff. But
you know what, that, Aaron, is what you just raised is an interesting thing. One of the things that's going on, one of the subtexts of the current debate and all this hoopla around instant offer is, to me, the vilification of the investor. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are picking up on that, but you know, there's this notion that the investor is being characterized as, you know, some Wall Street fat cat with his, you know, hair slicked back, you know, just coming in and, you know, taking advantage of homeowners and, you know, buying out their family home for like pennies on the dollar and just, you know, screwing them over. You might want to think about doing some series or doing something about what is the role of the investor in a real estate market. You know, are they a force for good? Are they a force for evil? You know, are they just, you know, out to screw people? Like, what, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, we've been advocates for the investor space for years because the real estate investment community doesn't have a national association. And Wall Street is very disconnected. When a lot of the Wall Street lenders came out, they were even speaking a different language in the hard money space, the private money lending space. People are like, what are you talking about? Like, this is Wall Street speak. Like, and you're working with people that get their hands dirty. They're in the communities and they're flipping. And I don't know. It was interesting to watch. And I was almost surprised to hear some of this stuff come up because I thought that they had really moved on to different markets and maybe the run was over and I honestly thought they were going to start going after lending opportunities because lending is such a problem right now to, you know, non-QM kind of product or something. But we'll see what happens with some of these new technologies if they end up deciding to still be in the ownership seat. If their goal is to still sort of build REITs with these single family homes, it'll be interesting to see.
Right.
You wrote a...
It's probably not for this show, but just telling you, in the future, you got to think about, you know, doing a show about, you know, the role of the investor in real estate. Because I'm telling you, there's something happening, and the rhetoric right now is something along the lines of the realtor is the only defense of the poor, helpless consumer against this, you know, evil, predatory investor class.
I would agree. I was also at a conference where, especially out here in California, markets that have gotten really hot, there's a conversation about affordability and homelessness that sometimes take the same track. I just wrote an article for Bigger Pockets talking about this. As affordability gets tighter, it's the landlords that are driving up the rents and driving up prices. And Wall Street did play a very important role in that in 2013 because they were buying at more than full market value at things like the trustee sale, driving up prices quickly. And a lot of, you know, would-be owners just couldn't compete, or they were still sort of licking their wounds on the sidelines. And now we're at where we're at now, to where we're almost at peak prices not seen since 05, 06. And that conversation, you're right, is starting, that the real estate investor is a bad guy. And what's going to be interesting to see is if people really bifurcate the traffic between Wall Street and the mom-and-pop real estate investor.
I don't think so. Because you know what? You think about one market where the investment activity really sort of created that kind of dynamic is Vancouver, British Columbia. And you look at what happened, you know, there politically as a result of that, as a result of affordability crisis. I don't think they're going to make a distinction between, you know, large institutions and individual rich people, right? Especially if we're talking about foreign money getting involved.
That's true. That's a third category. Interesting. Yeah, you know what? We'll have to watch that. That is a good point. Now, before I forget, I want to cover buyercurious.com because I had not read that until it was on your blog. And can you describe what that is and why it could be a little scary for realtors?
Oh God, was that 3 years ago now? I believe it was a gentleman out in, I would say it was in Illinois maybe. Where he just developed this platform for people to do the negotiation themselves, right?
Right. So it's just instead of, you could completely do without the realtor. And what happened to it?
I don't think they went anywhere. Because, you know, one of the interesting things about it is I do feel like the real estate space is one where the middleman adds value, right? I mean, if they're good. In other words, like, I've been in the industry, you know, forever, right? You know, I'm a lawyer by training. If I want to sell my house, you know, FSBO, I feel like I could totally do it. The issue is I don't want to do it. Like, I don't want to negotiate, like, okay, you can keep the curtains if I get, you know, I just don't want to do any of that. Right?
And are you signing all the right paperwork? Are you recording everything correctly?
I just don't want to deal with it. So I feel like, you know, these sort of do-it-yourself, you know, toolkits, I think there's a place for them. I do think that there are some homeowners or home buyers who do want to kind of do it themselves. That's great. You know, Home Depot sells all kinds of stuff. You know, if you want to make, you know, create your own bathroom, right? I don't. I'd rather just hire somebody and have them do it for me. So I don't think there's, you know, a whole lot of traction behind something like that.
Well, that's good. I didn't realize that it was 3 years old that it hadn't gone anywhere. So I was going to
say, you might get angry phone calls after this saying, no, what are you talking about? We're taking over the public. And I've been like, I'm an idiot. But, you know, I just haven't seen any much from that. And there are a number of companies, you know, that it's gone out there trying to make it easier, make it smoother. But you know what? I just don't see it, right? Because fundamentally, the home buying process is not painful and annoying because of lack of technology. It's painful and annoying because mortgage is painful and annoying, and because regulations are painful and annoying. Those aren't technological problems per se. They're really more policy, regulatory, and financial problems. And I don't think an app is going to solve that.
Not today. Not in this environment. Well, with our remaining time left, let's talk a little bit about the future, because I'm super nerdy and I watch way too much YouTube. Have you been following the co-living situation at all?
I have not. Talk to me about co-living.
They're calling it a dormitory for adults. The concept, I'm fascinated by that. And I lived in New York City. I lived on a cruise ship for 6 months, so I've lived in these situations and it was great. I don't need 5,000 square feet. I can live in a 100 square foot box and be completely happy. Just curious to know if you had seen any thoughts or seen any traction going on.
I think it's going to get a lot of traction in the CBDs, right? In the central business districts for sort of younger folks. What's funny about the co-living thing is I had this idea back in 1993. I just graduated college. I got a job, you know, at a hedge fund. And, you know, I'm renting this apartment in Manhattan. And I remember thinking to myself, all I ever do in this place is take a shower, sleep roughly 4 hours, right? Put on clothes and then go back to the office. And I said, why don't they just buy out 2-3 floors of the office building and charge me rent and just give me a room? You know, just give me a dorm. That's all I need. Right. I never cooked at home. I literally did nothing in my apartment that was costing me like $1,000 a month in 1993 dollars, other than shower, sleep, and, you know, and that's it. And just store my stuff. So I think this is going to really take off.
I laugh because when I lived in New York City, I lived up in Harlem and Washington Heights. And when I left for the day, the size of my backpack was hilarious. So I was the same way. If I had to go home, if I forgot something, I'm like, oh, well, or I guess I'll have to buy it while I'm out.
Exactly. You know, I'm going to pull an all-nighter at the office. I guess I'm going to buy some new shirts because, you know, I'm not going back.
Not going back. Well, okay. You did write an article about driverless cars and how you thought that that might change some real estate activity. What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, my take on driverless cars is the biggest impact, I think, is that the suburbs die. Like the central business district, you know, the downtown living, I don't think that's affected because it's just so easy to just, you know, walk out your front door and walk down to the bar or walk down to a restaurant. But the suburbs, I think, die. I mean, if I could be doing work or sleeping or eating breakfast during a 2-hour commute into work from the exurbs, right, from the country, I would do that all day long, right? And for the price, especially if I have children, why wouldn't I want like a farm on 10 acres, you know, that's 100 miles out of town, my car is driving me? I think that's going to be the preferred living arrangement for a lot of people.
Interesting. So you think it's going to be at either ends of the spectrum, so a lot more value like out in the countryside, more space, or the central business districts?
Correct.
Got it.
So, you know, because the suburbs exist because of the car. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And the limitations is the whole commuting and sitting in traffic and all of that. Well, if that commute time becomes something that you could do, you know, and actually be productive, or like I said, you know, just sleep or read your newspaper or do whatever thing you want to do, that changes everything, right? That really does change everything. So I think that's, you know, that's going to completely change what we think of as a city. I think it changes and kills off suburbia. And I think it means that we see a much more dispersion of population, I guess the way to think about it.
Interesting. I haven't quite heard that. So especially for those of us with rentals, sort of keeping that in mind as technology improves, you know, where people decide to live. Do you have any thoughts on how virtual reality is going to change the game, if anything?
I don't see that changing things so much. But it depends on like how real virtual reality is. Mm-hmm. But so here's something you need to know about me, Aaron. I'm kind of a weird freak about demographics. And I look at, say, San Francisco, you know, as an example.
Okay.
And I look at the fact that millennial family formation rates are way down, and they're getting married later and later in life. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know what happens as technology continues to advance. What happens to family formation? Right. And then you combine all, like, in other words, let's not look at one thing. Let's not look at driverless cars in a vacuum. If you combine that with virtual reality, which potentially could mean something like telepresence and working remotely, combined with the levels of education that requires, combined with, you know, family formation, combined with dating habits, combined with all of this. And I don't know what that future looks like. It's really hard to project out. But let's just say that I'm sort of mildly terrified about it, right? The birth rate in San Francisco is below replacement. Right. It's gotten to a point, and this was a couple of years back, where the city of San Francisco has to start closing schools because there aren't enough kids to attend those schools. Mm. What happens to real estate, you know, in that type of environment?
Right. Yeah, it's gotten a little bit crazy up there. They've flown past their peak price, flown by. I think in the last peak it was in the 900,000 range, and they're well beyond that at this point. So it just makes it almost impossible to have a normal life up there. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us. If people want to find your blog or get a hold of you, how would they do so?
My blog is Notorious ROB. Just Google it. And they can find me all over Facebook, all over Twitter. I'm at Rob Hahn on Twitter. And if they're in the industry, they could probably find me speaking at some event somewhere or another.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to be here again, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. It was my pleasure. Thank you, Aaron.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.